I am with Dr. Kate D. Medeiros from the Miami University of Ohio, and from the Department of Sociology and Gerontology. Dr. D. Medeiros is the O'Toole Family Professor in the Department of Sociology and Gerontology, and is an expert in qualitative inquiry, narrative gerontology, and we're going to learn a little bit about that today as we speak with her. If you don't mind, would you share a little bit with us about your current role as a gerontologist or aging expert? And really, how did you come to be interested in the field of gerontology or aging? Or perhaps, how did gerontology find you? If you don't mind, and kind of explain a little bit how you became a gerontologist and what your interests are.
Sure. Well, looking backwards, it all makes sense, although going forward, it made no sense at all. But my initial undergraduate degree was in English literature, and I love language and I love how stories work and how, devices in literature work to make us feel and think certain ways. But I knew I didn't want to pursue that as a career because I didn't want to spend my life being the number two Faulkner scholar or something like that. So fast forward, I ended up in Texas working at the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston, and I had gotten hired to work with university relations. And basically, I was a grant writer on call. So they would send me out to help departments who were working on grants. So I had the chance to go to the Institute for Medical Humanities and met with Tom Cole, who is a cultural historian best known for his Cultural History of Aging, an amazing book. And I became fascinated by the program. I enrolled in it, but the demands of life and everything else started to take its hold. So Tom said, "I have a feeling that you're going to drop out of this program, but before you do, why don't you take an independent study with me? And what I'd like you to do is see what people are doing as far as story writing groups for older people and find out what they're not doing, and let's do a project." And I thought, that sounds horrible. I had no desire to work with older people. I thought it would be sad or boring or whatever, but Tom's a pretty persuasive person. So anyway, that's what I did. I found that my background in English helped me realize that a lot of stories we hear are the stories we expect to hear, that things like memoir have an evolution from this form that was made really to extol virtue and accomplishment. So, I won't bore you with the details on the evolution of that, but essentially, when people do story work with older people, often what they're hearing is the story that they're supposed to tell and the story we want to hear, not the stories that are their lives. So that became fascinating to me. I loved the first writing workshop so much that I withdrew from his program, but I enrolled in the gerontology program at UTMB. So I worked with David Cherubogo and Bobby Yee and got my master's in gerontology, did a lot of education in the Galveston community. We relocated, my husband's Navy, so we relocated to the DC area right about the time that the PhD program was starting at UMBC, University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And there I got to work with Robert Rubenstein, who was a cultural anthropologist. And so they did a lot of work on things like the meaning of suffering in old age, or he had a large study on childless older women and their views of generativity. So I got to see a different side of things. Fast forward then, I got a postdoc at Hopkins and started doing dementia care. So a lot of the storying work I had been interested in applied, not so much, I worked with clinical geriatric psychiatrists. So not as exactly as an easy connection you might think, but really, spending time with people living with dementia and long-term care and seeing how their lives unfold in ways that people don't bother to pay attention to, conversations, friendships. So, if you spend time in this facility held, it had 167 beds, all of people with moderate to advanced dementia. And you might hear people having a conversation, and to you, it might seem nonsensical, but you realize there's a lot going on in the communication. So I was able to get some funding to take some additional courses from Georgetown and Hopkins and discourse analysis and other things to again look at language from a different way. So I would say that even though I often don't do things that apparently look like they're related to the way we communicate, I would say that that's the undercurrent of everything I do. And my main interests in gerontology right now are whose stories get to be told and why, what stories are we willing to listen to or not, and also listening as a key thing that we often don't do. We're really good about telling people what they need, but we're not really good about listening to what they want or that what would make their life better. And when I say they, I don't mean to other older people, but I mean, just when we're studying people, we tend to think of a them and an us. And I'm just very acutely aware of how those, you know, conversations unfold. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Yeah, well, a different route, a different pathway, trajectory to the field is pretty neat to hear. Now, given your expertise, a lot of your expertise is in this kind of narrative aspect of gerontology. And you've actually written a book, I believe, or a methodology book on narrative gerontology. Can you define what is narrative gerontology? That's kind of a different concept.
Yeah, so Gary Kenyon and Bill Randall first coined the phrase and narrative gerontology back in the 90s. And basically, when they envisioned narrative gerontology, was the idea that we age biographically as well as, you know, physically and socially, and, you know, and that our biographies have a huge impact. I see it a little bit different. And again, I do think that our biographies are important. But I also am acutely aware of, again, that biography and really autobiography and memoir imply a certain kind of thing. So, you know, I think about narratives as a way of unveiling some aspect of self. And so it could be through writing, it could be through language, but it doesn't have to be. It could be through art, it could be through dance, it could be through movement. But, you know, what we're doing is we're telling a story. And by story, that could be the grand story of, you know, here's my entire life, or it could be, here's this single moment in time that changed who I am, or here's something that happened to me yesterday that, you know, affected my day. So we call those big stories, which are the kind of the grand, or small stories, just those little things. We all tell these. The key about a narrative is it's more than just talk, but there are different ways you can define what constitutes a narrative. Usually there's a plot and there's some kind of action. So, you know, I could have a 2-sentence narrative. I could have a 3-hour narrative, you know, those are the kinds of things that I'm interested in. And as from a narrative gerontology standpoint, I look for those, especially small stories in the larger context of interviews, to find out what is it that we're missing. So, case in point, a colleague of mine, Gwen Etter Lewis, did a paper a couple years ago. We were interviewing underrepresented older people in Ohio, so predominantly people who identified as African-American, Hispanic, and then there was actually a small population of post-Soviet era Russians and Ukrainians in the Cincinnati area. And what we found were that without soliciting this, that a lot of stories about place were embedded in what they were telling us. So we went back and did an analysis on small stories of place. And the reason we knew that these were stories is sometimes people would say, let me tell you a story about that, or let me tell you this little thing about what happened. And so there were these markers that then we were able to pull out and say, wait a minute, these are all about place and how sense of place or belonging or not belonging had a huge impact on people's lives. So it's taking those little moments like that and then trying to figure out what are they telling us in the bigger picture of things about what we know about aging? You know, why don't we stop and think about those little moments? You know, we're often very concerned about these big things that happen, but not these little teeny things that have a huge impact on people's lives.
Yeah, so and you know, these little teeny things, these little cues in the stories, you talked just a minute ago about how we share those stories. Is there a most effective approach, do you think? Is it like through a play, through a media? Is it, you know, in today's world, we have so much that accessibility to storytelling on film, even. Is there one best way to take these little cues, these little stories, and share them?
No, I think there are any ways a good way, because any way you choose will elicit a very particular kind of story and not the true story or the real story. I mean, there's no such thing as true or real, right? So if I asked you to do a TikTok video about your life, you would immediately say, okay, what's in a TikTok video? Okay, it's about 2 minutes long, the long, you know, like, and then you would decide based on what you thought should be there about what you would want to tell. And that would be really different if I said, write a song about your life, because then you'd say, oh, okay, well, a song, then you might choose a memory or a situation that you think would make a good song. And so I find that it, you know, or a play. You know, is it a play about your life? Is it a combination? So regardless of what kinds of media we use, that media helps us filter what we're going to say and not say. So my thing is, don't just rely on one way, rely on a lot of ways. You know, even if you're doing a qualitative interview, for example, and you tell someone, tell me a story about your life. And then they tell you, and then you say, okay, if they were making a movie about your life, what would it be called? You know, who would star in it? What would be the biggest thing in the movie? You know, so you can, you know, even in those kinds of ways, shift the focus. Cause then again, you'd think, well, what's worthy of a movie? You know, what's worthy of a poem? And worthy, that's, I think that's people's words, not my words. I mean, people stop and think like, oh gosh, well, you would never say that in, you know, in this situation, or, you know, in dance, you can express different things than you can in language. So I think that multiple ways are best. And, you know, we learn different things regardless of what way we use.
Yeah. I mean, I hear stories all the time in my work, and it's just amazing. I sit there, and I'm sure you do too, when some of the older adults, I've interviewed centenarians, are talking. I actually, my mind goes wandering when they're telling their story, and I'm in a movie theater watching their life. I'm like, gosh, we can make millions on the side, right? Some of their stories are just amazing. Now, and it appears a lot of your experience, expertise, gerontology, has really focused, as you mentioned, underserved populations, that you have a keen interest in this, and really looking at the diverse, not only populations, but the context surrounding aging and the human condition, you know, whether that be caregiving or LGBTQ relations, stories from African-American populations. Each of these seem to kind of resonate what I would call a humanistic kind of gerontology. And in your work, in kind of cross-blending gerontology with humanities, how would you define like humanistic gerontology or humanities of aging?
I would say, you know, I work a lot with people who are humanities scholars who study aging. And so I would say that there's two kinds of people use humanistic in two ways. So some people use it to mean the humanities, and some people mean it to use humanism, which is a branch of philosophy, which is, you know, they kind of look the same, but they're a little bit different. So from the humanities perspective, one of the things that I think is important that I would define humanistic gerontology is being very concerned with the cultural messages that we receive that tell us how we should or should not age. So, you know, whether it's reading work by Andrew Achenbaum and looking at the history of aging, or Thomas Cole or Pat Thane or other people, or even the literature that we read. So, I mean, I guess a great point is that we know that in Western culture, living with your adult children is not a preference in many, many countries, with a few exceptions. We know that King Lear is all about why you shouldn't do that. I mean, it's got a lot of other, you know, obviously issues as well, but, you know, it repeats a message that you can see throughout literature and history, you know. So if you know the literature, and, you know, it can help you understand, you know, certain ways we think now, but it can also help you empathize with an experience in a way that scientific work can't. So, you know, I mean, we've all seen a movie where we just probably cry, or, you know, we can really relate, or it moves us. I mean, and we don't do that when we read scientific papers, typically. You know, we don't have the same feeling. I don't know. I don't. So, you know, it can be a way of also bringing an experience to light. So there's multiple aspects of that. But they ask different kinds of questions. So people who do humanistic gerontology don't ask how does it work. They ask what does it mean. You know, and so that it's just a different framing of questions.
And when you think about this kind of questioning, how does it allow scientists to understand aging as a part of being human, or the human experience, do you think?
I think that the humanities allow questions to be asked that can't necessarily be, validated through a study, but by raising the imagination can help scientists think of new questions. So I guess a great classic example is Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was the imagination that led to nuclear submarines and a lot of other things, you know? So at the time, it's this fantastical idea that you could live underwater and, you know, and yet it drove science to be able to say, well, wait a minute, you know, can we do that? I mean, not exactly that simple of a relationship, but, you know, so when we start saying things like the interest right now in social determinants of health, we can look at literature and writers who have been arguing about this for a long time and have produced novels where those wouldn't be their words, but really they're saying it's not just about, you know, your surroundings really matter. So I think that imagination, you know, and science go really well together, even though they tend to come from different camps of thinking. But I think when they can come together and share knowledge, that's where we get innovation.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes you think stories, you know, they take on a life of themselves or they are part of life. It's and you can really see that. Now, across the years that you've been a gerontologist, this is kind of a tough question, perhaps, but and the research you've done and the projects you've done, you know, all the things you've managed to be engaged with and conduct. What's that one discovery, do you think, or that one finding that has really intrigued you the most? That you perhaps has advanced the field in certain ways, or perhaps you just didn't expect it?
I would definitely say it was the friendship study among people living with dementia and long-term care. So it was a study that was funded by the Alzheimer's Association, but it really started because of the Hopkins facility. Staff wanted to know how to better integrate residents when they moved in. So that kind of started with that. That was the research question. How can we identify people who would get along well together? And so myself and my research team spent 6 months observing people in one particular assisted living unit in this large facility. And if you ask the staff who was friends with whom, we went through a whole matrix, and they were really bad at identifying friendships. So they went with stereotypes. Oh, the men at the men's table, they love to laugh. And 6 months, I never saw the men talk to each other. So that was out. But they did not identify people who were friends. And so understanding that it's not the person who doesn't have dementia who is the required person to make something meaningful. And that's a mindset that a lot of people have. I need to be the one to facilitate these friendships. I saw a lot of friendships spontaneously occur. Now, you might not remember your friend's name, but when you saw that friend, you knew that person. And you know, and you could ask people about what, you know, what was important in their friendships, and they could tell you, even though people often, others don't think of people living with dementia, especially with profound memory loss, as being capable of having those kinds of moments, or as it being a worthwhile, effort to try to cultivate those communities of care. And it's something I still feel very strongly about, the whole idea of, you know, how can we get people who are, you know, socially isolated, whether they have dementia or not, but new ways of thinking about what is it that makes our connections important. And what we found was, first of all, time, you know, stop interrupting people. Secondly, you know, make a setting that has things that people can talk about. So if you've got dementia, you have enough trouble remembering things. You don't need a sterile environment that gives you nothing to be able to say, oh, look, there are flowers. I like flowers. Do you like flowers? You know, and then you can start a conversation with a friend. So that to me still is something that I found very, very, very profound. And it's hard to convince people that it's important, because people often say, well, but we need to worry about health. And those are all important things. But I think most of us, if we were given a choice of having 10 good minutes, we would pay for 10 good minutes, right? You would say, my health is important, but I don't want to just be healthy. That's not the point of just being alive. But anyway, I'm still working on making that argument and getting funders to support it.
Well, yeah, for you wouldn't think about friendship with persons with dementia. You had mentioned there were some things that were markers or that they said makes for friendship. Did you, was there anything in particular that these individuals with dementia said, or even the caregivers noticed, like
No, to me, the caregivers were very well intentioned, and I don't mean to speak disparagingly of them, but for them, it was all about management, and they have a fixed amount of time, and I get that. So there was one resident, for example, who yelled, who couldn't communicate. She yelled a lot. I thought for the first 2 months that the person they sat with her at lunch also couldn't communicate, but that wasn't true. That person was perfectly able to have a perfectly coherent conversation. So why were they sitting together? Because she didn't get upset when the other woman yelled. So as opposed to allowing the second woman to have a conversational partner, they just the path of least resistance. So here was this opportunity for someone to be able to engage with another person, and she wasn't given that opportunity.
yeah, that makes sense. Management of behavior in a facility.
Right, and I get it. I mean, I do get it, and I know the people that do that work are under a lot of pressure to get a lot done. But if you could come in and then, so we couldn't predict that because that wasn't how the decisions were made. It was a marketing department. It was a management issue. So sadly, no.
Now, have you done work in terms of, and I've read in the past, it's just kind of a side question, I guess, that pops up and makes me think of this idea of like taking stories, you know, the narrative gerontology, narrative aging, taking the narratives of older adults, and particularly those with dementia or memory loss. We do a lot of, you know, as you've mentioned in roundabout ways, we deconstruct stories quite a bit. But I've read recently, and this has been something that's been around, reconstructing the stories of those with memory loss or dementia. Have you done any of that type of work? Or I know there's sort of like memory, I think there's like time slips or something like that, or there's programs out there, but the idea of trying to take bits and nuggets of a story, but you don't have the full story of one's life and you try to reconstruct it.
Not per se, because again, the problem with that becomes there isn't a story. All memory is person related. So, the challenge when you try to reconstruct someone else's story, you could get facts, but there are nuances, and you could get a spouse that might see that situation very differently than the individual, or the same with children, or friends or whomever. So I haven't done that. But the beauty of time slips, which I have worked with Ambasting a lot, is that time slips allows you, it's not based on memory. So it's kind of joint storytelling that's not grounded in anybody's past per se. And so it does what she calls failure-free storytelling. So it's those kinds of stories that are absolutely fascinating. But they may or may not have anything to do with somebody's biographical past.
Well, one final question. Our class is really focused on successful aging and components of successful aging, but there's a lot of debate, and there's been a lot of debate in the past and currently on this whole concept surrounding successful aging. What is your take or perspective on Rohan Kahn's framework, and how do you define successful aging?
So Rohan Kahn, to me, hijacked a concept that was very, very different if you look at its evolution. So I think that what they were able to do is catch on to an imaginative idea that really resonates with people. It's kind of like you probably have experienced this. Once you mention disengagement theory, that's all anybody wants to talk about, even though we know it's not, validated. But it's like it cannot it just it's the bane of our existence of like it's not disengagement, stop it. And the same with successful aging, because what they wanted to do is to create a way of understanding how to intervene with people who were having issues. So, do an epidemiological study where you set criteria, and that way you could better find, where the challenges seem to be, and then you could have interventions. But it's that model has just grown into something completely differently. If you back up though and look historically, the whole concept started in response to a paper in the 40s about the unsuccessfully aged. So it's this paper about, why are some people aging worse than others? then having Hearst turn that around and said, well, let's ask the question of why are people aging better? But in having Hearst's conception, personal assessment was a really key part, which has no part in Rowan Kahn's, but they're doing it for a different reason. And then if you look at Baltus and Baltus, you know, their successful aging that, you know, is later the selective optimization with compensation. Again, they're looking at a person's ability to compensate. But Rowan Kahn are saying, you know, I mean, medical model, we want to know what's going on here. And so I think it's really irritated a lot of people because it seems to imply that you failed aging somehow. You know, oh, you're unsuccessful, or what happens if you're unsuccessful? I would link this also with the third and fourth age constructs that are kind of the same, but new, you know, new retelling of it. You know, you're healthy and you're older, and then you're not. And I think that that's what we're really getting at. But I think the idea of successful makes it sound like you can fail aging, and it really rubs people the wrong way. But I do not think that that was at all their intent when I really believe that they were trying to have a model that would help provide insight into really like there's something going on with this group of people. What is it? How can we then intervene to help? Not like, oh, well, you're unsuccessful. Too bad. There is a line from the book, though, that really irritates me very much. And it's when they say that they applaud Stephen Hawking's efforts, but he could not be considered successfully aged. And then things like that, you think, really? I mean, I don't think Stephen Hawking would agree with you, but anyway.
I mean, he aged well. I mean,
yeah, he did a few things, you know.
Well, I appreciate your time, taking the time to ask you a few questions and spend some time with you, learning a little bit about what you do and some of the concepts that you engage with, and just the pathway and trajectory that you've had is really unique in terms of getting into the field and the contributions you certainly have made and continue to make. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for talking with me. It's my favorite subject to talk about.